Good evening. You're listening to Uncovering Oil on KGNU Radio in Boulder. I'm your host, Antonia Yuhas. Tonight's show is a special broadcast. As many of you know, I'm an investigative journalist, and this week I have two new articles published in Sierra Magazine, and I'm featured in an interview with Bill McKibben in The New Yorker. I'm excited to explore and expand on that content with you tonight with three guests whose experience, expertise, and writing were key to this reporting. Patricia Nelson, a Weld County, Colorado resident who's fought long and hard against the fracking industry here. Alexis Goldstein, a senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform, and Sarah Bloom Raskin, a former Federal Reserve Governor and former Deputy United States Treasury Secretary, each join us tonight. On the opening day of the Republican National Convention, Trump declared his intention to defend God, guns, oil, and gas. In my new Sierra Magazine cover article, The End of Oil, I write why the industry is so in desperate need of his defense. I found that it's clear that the oil industry will not recover from COVID-19 and return to its former self. What form it ultimately takes, or whether it will even survive, is now very much an open question. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought into sharp relief the existing frailties within the oil industry and then made each of them worse. As at no other time since the industry's inception, the actions taken now by the public and policymakers will determine oil's fate. In my second article for Sierra Bailout, I detail how the administration is providing that support through policy and through action by taking a deep dive into the ways that the COVID-19 recovery money is bailing out the oil and gas industry. With research organization documented, I found that up to $7 billion in PPP funds has gone to over 7,000 oil and gas companies and at least $3.2 billion to at least 50 oil and gas companies through a tax loophole in the CARES Act. Many of these benefits went to Colorado companies that then fired or furloughed workers. I also detail how the American taxpayer, with the Federal Reserve, is now a direct holder of fossil fuel company debt. These are the topics we're going to delve into, particularly the last, with the help of tonight's guests. My first guest is Patricia Nelson. Patricia lives in Greeley and is one of our state's most well-known and outspoken opponents of fracking. Greeley is the county seat of Weld County, which is home to nearly 90% of all oil produced here. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Can you please start by describing what led you to take on the fracking industry here? What were the impacts you and your family experienced, and what are these impacts like today?
Yeah, so it was one project that led me to become an activist here in Greeley. There was a 24-well pad site that was approved for development about 700 feet from the playground of a school, Val Romero Academy, that my son was going to be a student at. And that has just become my life now for the last almost 4 years. We have seen a lot of children, children in my family included, who have experienced a lot of mild symptoms. And so it's the typical nosebleeds, rashes, headaches, and I say typical symptoms, but the thing about these symptoms is that they're very, very mild, and, you know, unbeknownst to a lot of people, these are actually also symptoms of exposure to carcinogens. This last November, there was an air monitor at the school that detected elevated levels of benzene, and the CDPHE sent out a notice, and those exact symptoms I was describing are symptoms of exposure. And like I said, these symptoms are so mild that it's hard to distinguish whether or not you've been exposed to a carcinogen or whether your child is just going to get a cold or they're just feeling unwell that day. And so these impacts, you know, they're quite scary just because there's no way for us to know if it's one thing or another.
I've also visited you I think also for people who haven't been to Greeley or haven't spent much time in Weld County, I don't think they necessarily understand the scale of how inundated your neighborhood, the community is with fracking. I mean, can you just try and paint a little bit of a picture for people who haven't visited?
I mean, we're surrounded. I think I counted one time, I think it was close to 50 or 52 wells just within a mile of where we live. And there was a statistic that was shared to me with one of my friends that if you live in Weld County, regardless of where you live within a mile of an active well. And so, you know, it's every direction, everywhere you go, and even within city limits, there are oil and gas operations.
Okay. So, you know, you've been, as I said, a leader in these efforts to try and stop fracking across the state, but it's not just fracking right now that Weld County and Greeley are dealing with. It's also a part of the state that's been disproportionately harmed by COVID-19. Can you describe impacts there to you and your family and to your community?
So, you know, just personally, our family has definitely been impacted. But I had two of my sisters that tested positive for antibodies. And so they had COVID during a time where testing was not readily available. I had an aunt and her husband who had COVID and they had to stay at their home. She was not hospitalized. But right now I have an aunt who is currently in ICU due to COVID. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me was I had quit my job and I was thinking I'll just take a couple of weeks off and, you know, get back on it. But I ended up not working for 5 months.
And you would also describe to me that your husband lost his job as a result of the pandemic and that you had to tap into your 401k retirement plan.
I essentially wiped it all out. I mean, I had no income for 5 months. And, you know, even though there's a global pandemic, we still have to pay our bills. We still have to eat. And, you know, I didn't see any other option, especially because I'm considered high risk because of some health issues. So my doctor recommended that I stay home as much as possible, which meant at the time not working.
And because you had left your job before the pandemic, as you described, for health reasons, you also didn't qualify for the unemployment benefits.
Mm-hmm. And also one of the things that unemployment requires of you is to be actively looking for work. Mm. And so I wasn't able to actively look for work. And that's another one of the reasons that I had to just cash out my 401k savings.
And of course you have a 7-year-old son, Diego. In my article, again, in which you're featured, I detail how the Trump administration is spending billions of dollars in COVID-19 relief money to bail out the oil industry. And many of the oil companies in your neighborhood, as well as virtually every one of the largest operators in Colorado, are reaping tens of millions of dollars in pandemic recovery benefits among the billions of dollars that have been obtained by the industry nationwide. And many are laying off workers and company executives are giving themselves raises at the same time. I'm wondering, you know, what's your response to this federal bailout of the oil industry?
So I'm no longer surprised by what this administration chooses to do, but I am continually shocked. One of the things that was mentioned in your article is how one of the loopholes that was created, I feel like, for these companies was that they didn't have to prove that their company was being affected by COVID. And so they are literally getting billions of dollars just to get billions of dollars. And like I said, you know, not surprised, but continually shocked, especially because, you know, I personally know a lot of people who are struggling because of the loss of their job or the loss of hours at work. And yet, you know, the rich are continually getting richer, even during a global pandemic.
How would you prefer to see this COVID money spent? And particularly looking at, I know something that you have advocated a great deal is a, transition away from oil drilling and from fossil fuels and fracking, yet this industry is the same industry that's getting bailed out as a result of the pandemic. How would you prefer these federal monies be spent?
Absolutely. I really feel like a lot of this money needs to go directly, payments need to be made directly towards citizens. When you have, working class people like myself, we're not going to save that money because we have to spend it now. We have bills right now. We have to eat right now. Whereas you see all these companies are just going to take that money and they're going to take it and it's going to be offshore and then the next bailout's going to come out and they're just going to replenish themselves again. But I think right now would be a perfect time to encourage people, to start taking, online classes. And, those federal monies can go towards paying something like that. It's a really crucial time for change right now because of everything that's going on. And, right now we have the opportunity, to keep people at home and help them make life-changing changes.
I know that you have family that works in the industry as well, and I'm sure you see lots of people around you who, have lost their jobs due to the oil and gas industry laying off people, because one of the things we also found in the article was that even though oil and gas companies are taking this money, many are also simultaneously laying off hundreds of workers across the state and tens of thousands across the country. Money that would go to transitioning, helping those workers transition from fossil fuel jobs to green energy jobs.
Yeah, I actually had a couple of cousins that were laid off in the last couple of months. And so being able to tell them, hey, there's this program that you can sign up for retraining to work in solar or, training to work in building wind turbines or, something like that, I think would be a lot more helpful than, again, giving more money to people that already have a lot of money.
And you're saying cousins that were employed in oil and gas?
In oil and gas, yeah.
Okay. What about Extraction Oil and Gas, which is the company that is doing the drilling and fracking at Bella Romero, next to where you live and where Diego is going to go? They've filed for bankruptcy. And one of the rule changes that actually the Republicans are trying to implement is to make it possible for companies that have filed for bankruptcy to still get PPP, Paycheck Protection Program, money. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's just completely unfair. There are just so many loopholes that just need to be completely eliminated because these companies are continuing to operate, even though they are very, very financially unstable. And that should worry not only us, but everybody that, just everybody in general.
And this is something you've spoken about a lot, which is this expectation that you don't trust that the industry is going to be here for any significant amount of time. So all of this investment that's been going into this to the oil and gas industry, but also the harms that have been faced by you and others who live near these operations. You've talked about, what's it ultimately worth in the end if we can't trust them to stick around?
Yeah, I mean, Extraction Oil and Gas themselves had posted on Facebook that they see themselves in Weld County for at least 10 more years. I'm 30 years old. They're going to be gone in theory by the time I'm 40. And there are a lot of other people that are in this industry that are employed by this industry that are the same age as me. So what are they supposed to do when they turn 40? And, that just goes back to, retraining people now. So when this transition does happen, it's not going to be catastrophic to our economy or to our families.
And that was something that Extraction had said pre-COVID-19, before they filed for bankruptcy, right? That 10-year
yes.
estimate.
Yes.
What do you think, what should be happening here in Colorado? What do you want to see from Colorado's elected officials as we recover from COVID-19 or try to?
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult for a lot of people, a lot of politicians, to put themselves in working families' shoes, because a lot of them, you know, a lot of career politicians, you know, I feel like a lot of them are out of touch. And so I really feel like they need to come down into the streets and talk to people and find out what their needs are, because my needs are going to be completely different from somebody else's needs. But yet at the same time, they're still going to be about the same. You know, we are living in a time of such crazy uncertainty. And so I think, you know, just being able to have an open conversation with our elected officials is going to not only put more faith into them, but it's also going to help, you know, everybody feel like we're on the same page and we're going to be able to get through this. We're going to be able to get through this all together.
What do you want Colorado officials to do about the oil and gas industry? What should happen here in the state? You know, there's been a lot of push for green recovery plans, implementing a Green New Deal, you know, bans on fracking. You know, what do you think Colorado should do here?
I mean, there is a lot of talk from smaller communities that rely on the oil and gas industry. You know, the bulk of their revenue comes from oil and gas, but that's the time where we need to start diversifying these economies, even in Weld County. Our county commissioners have put all of our eggs in one basket, essentially. And so when oil prices dropped below $0, you know, that isn't going to have an immediate effect on our county's budget, but we know that it's coming. And so now is the time that we need to diversify our economies, just because the change is going to come and it's going to happen. And so, you know, creating more regulations in the oil and gas industry, I mean, I'm sorry to say, but it's going to weed out the companies that are not going to be able to stand the change. And like I said, the change is coming, and we need to create regulations that are going to help communities and not continuously hurt communities like mine. Right now, the COGCC, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation, is working on rulemaking. And, you know, there are so many changes that are coming just from that commission alone because of SB 181 that is supposed to create more regulations for this industry. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of pushback from a lot of oil and gas people.
I'm sitting here in Boulder. The impact of COVID in Boulder is not the same as it's been in Weld County. And can you help us understand what it's been like to try to fight these twin battles at the same time? The battle that continues on fracking for you, and now the harm to your family and your community from COVID.
You can't keep the polluted air in Weld County, and you may not even be able to keep, you know, this virus contained to Weld County. And so what happens in Weld County not only affects us in Weld County, it's going to eventually affect everybody else in the state.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. My guest is Patricia Nelson. She's a Weld County resident and mother, and she is featured in my new Sierra Magazine article called Bailout. Thanks so much for being with us today, Patricia.
Thank you.
Joined next by Alexis Goldstein. She's a senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform. She began her career on Wall Street, and she's the first person I called when writing Bailout to help me make sense of the Federal Reserve programs implemented in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, some of which she's found are disproportionately aiding the nation's oil and gas industry. Thanks so much for joining the show, Alexis.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's just start off right at the top of the line with something that you explained to me, which I think is quite startling, which is that the American taxpayer, you and I, are now owners with the Federal Reserve in oil company debt. Can you explain, you know, how that came to be and why that is potentially problematic from your perspective?
So after the pandemic sort of, once everyone sort of accepted that this was going to start to wreck the economy and the stock market was crashing back in March, the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States and is headed by a guy named Jerome Powell, basically came out and said that they were going to do whatever it takes to rescue the American economy. And they took a series of steps, which included creating 11 programs total. But two of the programs that they created to try and make sure that they could support the economy were programs that would be buying corporate debt. And this is something that the Central Bank of the U.S. has never done before. In the last financial crisis, they absolutely bought different kinds of debt, like they would let banks trade in some of their toxic mortgage-backed securities and they would hand them back U.S. treasuries. But they never went out and bought the corporate debt of companies before. So two of these programs are buying corporate debt, and one of them has already bought more than $315 million worth of fossil fuel company debt. And people, you know, may not know that that's happening, and they may not know that on behalf of, you know, all of us, the public, the Federal Reserve now owns the debt of some pretty big fossil fuel companies like Exxon, like Chevron, like BP, and some that have been involved in pretty controversial projects like Energy Transfer. And we can go on down the line. There's a bunch of them, but there's millions and millions and millions of dollars in these bonds that the public now basically owns together with the Fed because of these emergency programs that were meant as a pandemic response. And I should say they don't just own fossil fuel company debt, right? They're buying debt of lots of other companies. But I think some of the data we've seen is they're sort of disproportionately owning fossil fuel company debt versus other business sectors.
So can you explain that second part?
The central bank, the Fed, is meant to be what's called sector neutral. And what that means is they're supposed to not choose winners and losers. They're just supposed to take actions that reflect what is already out there in the economy. That's one of their missions. They have many missions which intersect, right? So they have to balance them all. But if you would just look at, say, how many employees different companies had, you would be able to come up with some percentage of the total economy that employs you know, workers at fossil fuel companies versus telephone companies versus banks versus whatever. And so InfluenceMac looked at how many, sort of what percentage of the overall workers in the U.S. economy are employed by fossil fuel companies. And they found that the Fed bought a larger percentage of bonds than that, than the number of the sort of percentage of workers employed by fossil fuel companies would suggest. They also looked at the composition of, so the stock market has a bunch of different tracking indexes. One of them is the S&P 1500. It's meant to be a measure of the 1500 sort of, you know, quote unquote, most important companies in the U.S. stock market. If you look at the sort of percentage of fossil fuel companies in that index, you know, the percentage of fossil fuel debt that the Fed bought is larger than the percentage of fossil fuel companies in the S&P 1500. And then they also just looked at bonds, sort of corporate bonds in the overall market. And once again, the Fed has a bigger percentage of corporate bonds in this sort of portfolio that they've assembled than sort of benchmark, you know, Wall Street analyst bond tracking tools would suggest. So they looked at three different things, and each one it came back that the Fed was buying more fossil fuel debt than really any Wall Street analyst, I think, would probably have predicted based on these three different measurements.
So, you know, that raised a number of red flags for you looking at that, you know, looking at those purchases. And can you, you know, walk us through sort of why you think that might be the case, why there is this overweight being given to fossil fuel purchases by the Federal Reserve, why that might be, and then why that raises, you know, the reasons why that raises red flags?
So one of the biggest concerns I think that advocates have had is the Fed being unduly influenced by politics, right? Because the Fed is supposed to be apolitical. They're supposed to be independent of the executive branch and the president. But the president has been very open and brazen about, you know, coming out and saying, we're going to do whatever we need to do to rescue American oil companies. He's been very open about that. And the U.S. Energy Secretary has also been very, very open about that. We're going to do whatever it takes. And there's been a lot of lobbying both by fossil fuel companies themselves, and then a lot of, you know, oil advocacy trade groups like the Independent Petroleum Association of America. They lobbied the Fed and they said, hey, some of your programs are too restrictive for U.S. oil companies, especially some of these smaller U.S. oil companies. Senator Ted Cruz, you know, wrote the Fed the letter, a letter saying the same thing. And then the Fed made the very changes that the fossil fuel lobby and Senator Ted Cruz asked for. And then the energy secretary went on Bloomberg television and he said, we asked the Fed to make the changes and the Fed made the changes and thank you very much. And so I think there's a lot of concern among advocates that the reason that the Fed is overweight in fossil fuels may be because of this very open, very aggressive lobbying, you know, from both Republicans all the way on top to the president.
And you've explained that it's not just these only these direct purchases. So, you know, right now there's about $300 million that's documented in these direct purchases that the Fed has made into the debt of oil and gas and petrochemical companies. But then there's also what you described to me as the sort of signal that is sent to other investors that these purchases are worth making. And I had noted that immediately after these variety of programs that the Federal Reserve announced to address COVID, immediately after the programs were announced in March, ExxonMobil, for example, went straight out and borrowed nearly $10 billion in the U.S. corporate bond market. And that, you know, is part of the money that is essentially going to prop up the industry. Can you explain that second part, the signal part?
When the Fed is, you know, announcing and disclosing that they are buying the corporate debt of all of these different fossil fuel companies, you know, not just the giants like Exxon and Chevron, but some of these other players like Energy Transfer, it's really the market is going to take it as a signal of confidence from the Federal Reserve that these companies are, you know, good companies that are worth investing in, that are worth putting the public's, you know, backing on. And I think that that cannot be the sort of impact of that cannot be overstated, right? Because this is the arguably, I think, the biggest central bank in the entire world sort of putting implicitly its seal of approval on all of these companies that it's buying the debt of.
And that's, of course, at a time that this industry is in, you know, a historic financial, you know, tragedy for itself, facing some of the worst financial circumstances it's ever faced. And that was happening pre-COVID-19. So this isn't an industry that was doing great and then COVID-19 hit. And so now the Fed is, you know, sort of helping support it in the wake of COVID-19. Rather, the industry was, for many intents and purposes, facing a financial catastrophe well before COVID-19 hit, with profits collapsing, investors looking elsewhere for money, enormous amount of bankruptcy and demand falling and all of that, oil glut, well before COVID-19. And one of the reasons why it was in such trouble is because the public has been demanding policies that shift away from fossil fuels, and that's been happening. And so now you've got essentially the Fed coming in and saying, you know, potentially, don't worry, we've got it. Like, we'll, you know, we've got this industry and we'll be, you know, we think it's got a future.
And I think this is a point that's not lost on people that used to be at the Fed itself. Exactly what you just said, Antonia, which is just that this is the wrong move. This is an industry that, you know, for a decade or more has been making bad bets, and we shouldn't be propping up an industry that is, you know, perhaps going to cost the public money in the future now that we are bondholders as the world makes this shift and starts to transition away from fossil fuels. This is really not forward-looking. And to my earlier point, it really doesn't work to promote financial stability given how troubled this industry has been for so long. And just one other sort of specific point, I mean, Exxon is one of the larger companies of the fossil fuel firms that the Fed has been buying the bonds of. Exxon just get kicked out of, so there's another market tracking index called the Dow, and it's only 30 companies, and Exxon has been in the Dow since 1920, and it just got kicked out of the Dow, I think this week or last week. And it came on the heels of Exxon announcing that they were going to lay off workers in order to not cut their dividend to shareholders. And so these are companies that continue to struggle. These are companies that are laying off workers. So I really find it hard to find an argument for why we should have the Fed and implicitly the public kind of holding the bonds of these companies that are really, I think, as you know, former Fed Governor Sarah Bloom Raskin said, part of a dying industry.
Yeah, that Exxon is one of the original Dow Jones, Dow Jones Industrial Average members in its previous incarnation as Standard Oil of New Jersey, and you know, as someone who has spent a very long time reporting on the history and writing books on the history of the oil industry, to see essentially Standard Oil kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial Average is a clear signal that something fundamental has changed in the U.S. economy. But let's just turn quickly to this one of the other big pieces, which is that BlackRock is been given the task of steering. So there's $75 billion in taxpayer funds that's being used to seed $750 billion that BlackRock is steering into the corporate debt market on behalf of the Federal Reserve. And one of the results of which is that, as you've explained to me, two of its investment funds that include energy stocks have been surging. Can you explain that piece?
When the Fed made this announcement, BlackRock's bond tracking funds surged. Investors poured into them, started buying them up. They hit, you know, record numbers of, you know, total assets that were invested in these products. You know, BlackRock is a very big company. It's very, I think, systemically important. It's, you know, there have been articles written about it that it's almost like, you know, a shadow fourth branch of government. It's very powerful. And I think we should all be very concerned that this company is having such a big role in these rescue programs that the Fed is standing up.
BlackRock has also been the target of campaigners for years. One reason being the nearly $90 billion in its fossil fuel portfolio alone in 2019. Is the result of this money that BlackRock is facilitating the expenditure of that more oil companies are being propped up that would otherwise have failed because they're getting their debt supported?
I mean, I think it certainly doesn't hurt the oil companies that the Federal Reserve, you know, and it's being executed by BlackRock, is, you know, the Federal Reserve now holds all of these oil companies' debt. And in a recent congressional hearing, Representative Ann Wagner asked Chairman Jerome Powell, do you intend to hold this corporate debt into maturity, which is another way of saying, you know, are you going to sell this tomorrow? Or are you going to hold it until the bond is basically done? And he said, yeah, we generally hold things to maturity. So I think, you know, a lot of these bonds are five-year bonds. So that means the public is going to be, you know, these sort of implicit owners of Exxon and Chevron and all these other fossil fuel company debt for the next, you know, 4 to 5 years. And I don't see how that couldn't extend into the marketplace as a sign of confidence that these companies are going to stick around for a little bit while longer. And, you know, BlackRock with its ETFs, they're constantly changing the composition of it every day, but the energy sector is consistently, you know, a pretty big chunk of their corporate bond buying ETFs. And so I think there's sort of this support for the fossil fuel companies on both ends, both from the direct bond purchases and from the ETFs. And I just don't see how it couldn't benefit them secondhand when the most powerful central bank in the United States is basically coming in and saying, yes, this is good enough for us to purchase.
Is there, you know, anything else you want to make sure people understand you know, the sort of key takeaway from this, these investments?
I think it's important for people to understand that the U.S., both through Congress and through the Fed, decided not to put any major conditions on these relief programs except for the airline bailout, right? The airline got a specific bailout that was contingent on them keeping workers on payroll. None of these other emergency programs, none of this bond buying we've been talking about have any real meaningful conditions that say you cannot fire your workers if we, the Federal Reserve, buy your bonds. And so this is a decision that both Congress and the Fed made not to put strings on these emergency relief programs. And I think that that's a real mistake. And I think the failure to put conditions on it is leading both to what we've been talking about here, right? Overweighting in sectors that may be dying sectors, but also it means that more workers are going to lose their jobs because the, you know, the companies taking this money are going to be under no obligation to use that money in a way that preserves jobs.
It's really important points. And I think a number of the companies that we are now owners of the debt of have been firing their workers. You know, as you say, there is no condition that they don't, and they are. And the whole point of the CARES Act was supposed to be that the American worker gets protected through this money. And you know, you're, as you're saying, the Federal Reserve programs have no such requirements. Also fascinating, you can read a lot more from Alexis Goldstein in my article, my new article, Bailout, in Sierra Magazine, and you can find her work at Americans for Financial Reform, where she's a senior policy analyst. Alexis, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Uncovering Oil on KGNU Radio in Boulder. I'm your host, Antonia Juhas. My third guest tonight is Sarah Bloom Raskin, a former Federal Reserve Governor and former Deputy United States Treasury Secretary. She's a visiting professor at Duke University Law School. Thank you for joining the show, Professor Raskin.
Happy to be here, Antonia.
In a New York Times op-ed you published in May, you wrote, "The coronavirus pandemic has laid bare just how vulnerable the United States is to sudden catastrophic shocks. Climate change poses the next big threat. Ignoring it, particularly to the benefit of fossil fuel interests, is a risk we can't afford." Your op-ed is entitled, "Why is the Federal Reserve spending so much money on a dying industry? It should not be directing money to further entrench the carbon economy." I think this is such an important op-ed, and I wanted to ask you why you decided to write it, and what were the messages that you were most hoping that it conveys?
Well, thank you, and thanks for giving me, you know, the opportunity to talk more about this. And I think there has, in fact, been this real up close and personal a sentiment that has come with the pandemic, which has touched so many of us and so many people in the world. And the initial thought around the pandemic was like, well, we better do something to eliminate the pandemic and then the economic costs attendant to the pandemic. And that should be the first order of business. And you saw initially huge amounts of spending coming both from fiscal authorities and from monetary policy authorities, meaning the central banks, just shooting a lot of money out there in a very fast and unprecedented way. And that was all, you know, that was all to the good. But it occurred to me at the same time, Antonia, that with all of this spending, what would be the point of it if, in fact, we were not doing anything to actually build back in a more resilient way? So it's a little bit like the three little pigs, and they they rebuild the straw house and they build it again out of straw, and it's just going to blow down again. And we know with climate change that the risks attendant to a warmer planet are absolutely imminent. and that we're living through it now. So if we are spending money like this, why are we not taking the opportunity to actually spend it in a way that will bring about a more resilient economy, more resilient features, so that as climate change progresses and as we feel more and more the imminence of the pain and suffering that comes with it, we are actually doing something to be stronger. So it occurred to me that we could be combining really the approach towards fighting the pandemic, both on the health front and the economic front, with an approach towards dealing with climate change. We could, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. There is absolutely no reason why we can't be doing this simultaneously. And it also seems to me that if we don't do it simultaneously, we're actually wasting money.
And isn't there, you know, I was saying to you before we started that I, like many people, find, you know, some of the policies of the Federal Reserve confusing and hard to understand. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so important to get this, you know, sort of glimpse into its operations and the, and obviously critical importance of them. It isn't one of the requirements of the Federal Reserve that its investments be risk averse, right? That it's supposed to be protecting the economy from risk.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's actually, it's important to be thinking intuitively too about what it is economic policymakers are supposed to be doing. And they are supposed to be preparing us for risk. A lot of times people will say, well, wait a minute, it's certainly not the Fed's role to be, you know, to be dealing with environmental regulations and dealing with, you know, dealing with the warmer planet. And I say, that's exactly right. It isn't their remit to be engaged in the actual changing of the temperatures of our climate. But what they should be doing is helping the financial sector and people's and the economy more broadly understood be prepared for the risk that is coming. And it's no matter where a risk comes from. It can come from, you know, it can come from climate, it can come from subprime mortgages, it can come from a public health emergency, it can come from a cyber attack, wherever it comes from. If it is going to affect the economy, it is within the remit of our economic policymakers to be thinking about it and figuring out how to cushion that blow. So it's a, you know, it's a subtle distinction, but one I think that's worth remembering, because so many times, you know, the Fed is gonna say, oh, but we don't deal with climate change. Right, we know that. We know you don't deal with climate change, but you do deal with helping cushion a risk, mitigating the pain that an economy will go through and financial markets will go through and households and businesses will go through if we are not prepared.
And then, so you go on to say that, you know, in very clear terms, even in the short term, fossil fuels are a terrible investment. It forestalls the inevitable decline of an industry that can no longer sustain itself. And that you said the decision to bring oil and gas into the Fed's investment portfolio not only misdirects limited recovery resources, but also sends a false price signal to investors about where capital needs to be allocated. It increases the likelihood that investors will be stuck with stranded oil and gas assets that society no longer needs. So can you first explain to us, how is it that the Fed is now has oil and gas in its portfolio? What happened to make that happen? And then, you know, why you think this is such a terrible investment for essentially the American taxpayer through the Fed, right, to be making?
Right. So the Fed has launched extraordinary monetary accommodation to deal with the economic effects of the pandemic. And in the midst of that, of those tools that the Fed has launched, are tools that essentially are lending and purchasing assets that are in the oil and gas arena. What they've done essentially is they have created programs that have so few criteria attached to them that they are bringing in to the, you know, into the Fed portfolio collateral and different assets that are in essence not going to be worth a lot in a carbon valueless economy. So essentially the Fed has cast its net very wide, so wide in fact that it has picked up assets, carbon-based assets, that are not going to be valuable to the American people. And why it matters what the Fed is picking up is because these are assets that now sit on the Fed's balance sheet, right? They have essentially moved from being, you know, held by private investors to be held by American taxpayers. And so the question has to be asked as to whether the choice to do this is ultimately going to be the best way forward if we are trying to transition to a cleaner economy. And that is, I think, one of the big risks with what the Fed is doing. And they're doing it too in the context of having, you know, there's absolutely no disclosures regarding what the carbon footprints are of the various companies that the Fed is purchasing up in its various programs. And I should, you know, I want to be, you know, be more precise. It's actually not that they're purchasing firms, but they are in essence creating demand, purchasing corporate bonds and corporate bond ETFs, exchange traded funds, which contain portfolios of different kinds of companies. So this is being done in the context of having no visibility to the carbon footprints or the carbon transition plans or the transition into renewables that that essentially our country needs in order to transition well towards the warmer climate that we're all facing. So that is the concern, and I think that we would be well served. The future, the next generation would be well served to be having a set of criteria to these programs that would be taking into account what the carbon footprints are of the entities that are being bought up, and also, you know, to have some, you know, it would help investors know, like, you know, where should we be putting our capital right now? Should we be putting capital into firms that have so-called stranded carbon assets? Or should we be putting our capital into firms that are really trying to innovate and do something in the renewable side and create clean jobs? So that's really the point.
And you had also, you know, laid out just all of this risky debt that the industry is buried under. Many fossil fuel companies spent the past decade recklessly expanding production, even as they failed to turn a profit. Oil and gas companies now hold $744 billion in bonds and debt, much of it below investment grade or close to it. Almost 83% of the industry's debt is now eligible for cheap refinancing by the Fed, and taxpayers shouldering these liabilities are a bad deal. Explain more in sort of what that means, why this is problematic.
Right. The kinds of firms that don't deserve to survive are firms that essentially can't meet that demand, can't innovate, can't be strong competitors. And so we want a competitive landscape, and you want firms that are able to think about, in particular, you know, what a climate stressed, you know, planet looks like, and how do we deal with it through the deployment of new technologies and new new innovations and, you know, new kinds of jobs. Those are the firms that you want to see thrive. And investors want to go to those kinds of firms because those are the firms that are the firms of our future, where people think there will be high demand for, you know, for wind power, for solar power, for, you know, different technologies that, you know, that haven't yet been scaled, but that we know could have a huge difference in tackling climate change. And what happens is if you have monetary or fiscal policy that essentially makes that playing field unequal, that essentially subsidizes firms that are not poised well for our future, to continue to get kind of, you know, life support from the federal government at the expense of firms that we know are innovative and have ideas and new technologies and are competitive. Well, then we have a problem, Antonio, where we have essentially an unequal playing field, and we end up supporting and encouraging the development of firms that really need to be redeploying their assets in a different way, need to be directed in a different way, and they need to get the lesson, sort of the free market lesson, that the demand for their products is dwindling.
One of the other pieces of the Fed program is that the Federal Reserve established its own index of bonds to purchase, and that in those purchases, that's how essentially the U.S. taxpayer through the Fed has directly holds corporate debt, including a long list of oil, gas, pipeline, petrochemical, and other companies, including ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Marathon, Phillips 66, et cetera. And there's a group called Influence Map, which compared the weight of the purchases that were in oil and gas to, for example, other index like the S&P 1500, and found that the Federal Reserve's bond purchases overweighted fossil fuels by comparison. Are you familiar with that analysis, and you know, what do you think that means?
Right. So I haven't tried to replicate the analysis, but I've read it and am familiar with it. And essentially, it's accurate. The Fed, in as part of its emergency lending authority, that it was given to deal with the pandemic, what it did was it established approximately 9 special lending facilities. And 2 of them are just the 2 that you described, Antonia, having to do with corporate bond purchases. And this is what that report is referring to. If you look at the purchases that the Fed is making through its agent, BlackRock, you will see that there is a heavier weighting of oil and gas than might be desirable. But that's, you know, the Fed and BlackRock would argue that they are doing this in a blind way, that they're not paying attention to what industries they're actually are actually represented in those bond purchases, and that they are applying broad criteria that don't favor any particular industry.
But does it behoove them if it turns out that they are, if those purchases, then, you know, even if they don't mean to, if they end up being overweighted, is there a responsibility to change that?
You would think that would be an enlightened way to proceed, and it wouldn't, and it's not far-fetched, because what the Fed would need to do would be to determine a criterion that could, you know, that would in essence focus the purchasing on firms that will have value in, say, you know, 10 to 20 years in that kind of long-term range, and it direct its agent, BlackRock, to purchase the firms that meet that, or purchase bonds of the firms that meet those criteria. Again, I don't think the criteria should be as simple as, you know, screen out oil and gas, or be heavy on airlines, or put a lighter touch on, say, hotels. You know, I'm just making that up. I don't think it should be industry specific. I think it should be driven by the financials of the particular firms that are issuing the bonds. So I think there should be financial criteria that match the interests of Americans in the next 10 to 20 years.
One of the things that you argued in your piece is that essentially, you know, this comes back to your op-ed in the New York Times, that, you know, renewable energy has shown itself to be, you write, generates roughly three times as many jobs as comparable investments in fossil fuels, that these is, it's one of the fastest, sorry, jobs in clean energy, such as wind technicians and solar installers, are the fastest growing of any industry in the country over the past 5 years. And that essentially these are safer, better bets for investment in the future. Right?
This That's is one right. of the points That's right. And if we could translate those kind of markers into objective criteria, which I think is possible, then I think you can imagine a corporate bond buying program that that purchases assets on behalf of Americans that will be in essence poised to be very valuable and to be something that sets us up for future success and doesn't leave us hanging with with just junk.
How unusual is it that the U.S., that the Fed did set up this program, that the U.S. taxpayer through the Fed is now the holder of this type of corporate debt? How unusual is that?
It is, there are features of it that are very unusual, okay? So this is the first time that the central bank in the U.S. has engaged in corporate bond buying. Okay, and it was done very early in the course of the pandemic, you know, the economic response to the pandemic. It had never been tried before in the US, never been piloted even before in the US. There are maybe a couple of central banks in other countries that have talked about it as an idea, but it has not, it's not a tried and true kind of technique. Now, to the Fed's defense, you know, they would say, well, this is not, you know, nobody expected a pandemic here. We had to throw in all ammunition. We had to turn on all the fire hoses simultaneously, whether or not we knew they were going to work, and we would deal with any kind of water damage later. But that the, that the immediate need was to throw all possible tools at the problem. And that's really essentially what's happened. So in that sense, Antonia, this is not a, this is not something that has been done before. It is unprecedented. It is unproven. It is, something that will have long-term consequences.
You know, what are the big takeaways that you hope that listeners will get?
So I hope listeners get, you know, get a sense of the, critical importance to all of us with what kind of actions the Fed takes, you know, in good times and in bad times. I mean, it's very tempting to kind of turn off the, you know, this notion of the Fed and monetary policy from the, you know, current reel of things that we, you know, that we think about and follow. But you can see that they have enormous influence over the economy, and the economy has huge influence over the course of our lives. And the people at the Fed, some are, you know, some have gone through, you know, nomination and confirmation and are nominated and vetted, and you know, others come through particular private channels And, you know, so it's mixed in terms of the way it's been created. But you know, and some are, and some, you know, but nobody is elected. and yet this, you know, this, the Federal Reserve System is something that, you know, exerts huge influence over the course of our lives and over the course of what our futures will look like. And that includes a future that is one that is prepared and has been prepared to deal with the critical emergencies of our time. And while most people would think, well, the Fed, what does the Fed have to do with, you know, with climate? Well, it turns out there are these, you know, strong linkages between climate change and financial stability, and financial stability and the economy in our lives. And once you understand that those connections exist, you start to see how important it is that we have a Federal Reserve that is, you know, and economic policymakers more generally, who are thinking about the future and using their best talents to make sure that, you know, our lives and the lives of generations to come are prepared and can imagine a society worth living in.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. My guest, Sarah Bloom Raskin, a former Federal Reserve Governor and former United States Treasury Secretary. She is a visiting professor at Duke University Law School. The New York Times op-ed published in May is entitled, "Why is the Federal Reserve spending so much money on a dying industry? It should not be directing money to further entrench the carbon economy." Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for being here. I'm glad to have been here.
That does it for tonight's show. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I'm Antonia Yuhas. The show is Uncovering Oil, and this is KGNU Radio. Have a great evening.